Daniel chapter 11. We began a series through this chapter last week, and we titled it, "The Devil is in the Details, but God is Over All." And we are going to see the devil in the details of a man we'll meet in this passage today for sure. But we'll also meet the reality that God is sovereign over all, no matter what the devil does on this planet. While returning to Daniel 11, let me begin by reminding everyone that we're in a study of the book of the prophet Daniel. The last half of this book is prophecy. The first half was a series of narrative stories. We're in the section that is a series of visions, but given by God to the prophet Daniel. And we've come to the final vision that is expressed in chapters 10, 11, and 12. And today we find ourselves in the middle of chapter 11, where Daniel is told of a coming abominator, a coming persecutor of the Jews, a coming horrible, despicable man. So understand that you're joining a conversation between an angel and Daniel when we drop into our passage today. If you're a guest with us today, you just walked into the middle of a conversation. And I feel a little bit for you. Hopefully you'll have some context for it. But an angel has been telling Daniel of the set of prophecies about the coming future so that the people of Israel would know what's coming. After revealing to Daniel that there will be a cycle of battles between the superpowers of the day, Syria to the north and Egypt to the south, now it comes to be focused on what happens to the meat of the sandwich in between, which is Israel. If you can think of a map, and I got to get the orientation right for you, you have the Mediterranean Sea to the west, you have Syria and Egypt, and right in between Syria and Egypt is Israel. Syria and Egypt have been warring together in our passage we saw last week, battling back and forth between the Ptolemies, who were the ruling family of Egypt, and the Seleucids, who are the ruling family of Syria. Now, another name they had were the Antiochuses and the Ptolemies. And it gets really confusing because there's Ptolemy 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, Antiochus 1, 2, 3, 4. Got to keep that a little bit straight. And we delved into that last week in some detail. But I just want to, just a little bit of context. If you're a guest with us, we're so glad you're here. But you have come in the middle of a mess on this world that Daniel is told by the angel that God is actually superintending and exercising sovereignty over. So let me just read the passage for us, and then we'll go through it verse by verse. We stopped at Daniel 11:20 last week, and now we pick it up. In his place, we'll talk about who that is in a minute. A despicable person will arise on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in at a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. The overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. After an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception and he will go up and gain power with a small force of people. In a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm, and he will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder and booty and possessions among them, and will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time. He will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army, so that the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war, but he will not stand, for the schemes will be devised again. For schemes will be devised against him. Those who eat his choice food will destroy him, and his army will overflow. But many will fall down slain. As for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil, and they will speak lies to each other at the same table. But it will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time. Then he will return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the holy covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land. At the appointed time, he will return and come into the south, but this last time, it will not turn out the way it did before, for the ships of Kittim will come against him, and therefore he will be disheartened and will return and become enraged at the holy covenant and take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. Forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice. They will set up the abomination of desolation. By smooth words, he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant. But the people who know their God will display strength and take action. Those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many, yet they will fall by the sword and flame and by captivity and plunder for many days. Now when they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join them in hypocrisy. Some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. I've had a long fascination with illusionists and magicians. I remember saving money when I was a younger man to go to the Memorial Auditorium in Chattanooga, Tennessee to see the famous David Copperfield. He was a famous magician of a generation ago, and watching his act was mesmerizing. At one point in the act, Copperfield, how many of you remember David Copperfield? You're all old. At one point in the act, Copperfield called up a member of the audience, a volunteer, to the stage and predicted what the volunteer would choose from a deck of cards. I wanted to be that volunteer, but I didn't get chosen. He said, I'm going to tell you the card you're going to choose, spread out the cards, and the dude chose the card that he predicted. How did he do that? For 2 hours, I kept asking, how can he do these things? But in recent years, with the advent of the internet and YouTube, it's popular for certain treacherous and traitorous magicians to reveal how all those tricks work. I've watched those videos. Have you? Frankly, it's pretty disappointing going, oh, that's all it is? It's just smoke and mirrors. It's just trickery. It's kind of disappointing. Now, here's the deal. The book of Daniel makes predictions, many predictions, very specific predictions. This is especially true in the text before us in Daniel chapter 11. And as we've noted, liberal scholars refuse to believe that these things were written in Daniel's time, centuries before their fulfillment, because they are so specific. How can anyone know that these things were going to happen the way they did? So they say, well, this was written after the fact and said to be written before the fact. I did something last night, full disclosure, watching some March Madness games. I was finished with my sermon and just thought, I just want to know. I've never done this before, but I asked AI what it thought about this chapter. And this is what I got back. Can I say quote? I don't even know who this is. So, I don't even know what to do with that. I'm quoting what the AI is, but I don't know who I'm quoting. Anyway, this is what it says. Quote-ish. Scholarly consensus suggests that the book of Daniel, including chapter 11, was likely written in the mid-second century BCE around the time of the Maccabean Revolt in 167 to 164 BC in reaction to the persecution of the Jews by Antiochus IV Epiphanes. End quote of AI. Not surprised by that. Not surprised at all. We, though, believe that Daniel wrote this book and these prophecies during the time of the Babylonian captivity, the 70-year captivity. And you know what? So did Jesus. He quoted from the prophet Daniel without saying, you know, the prophet Daniel, at least the part that was written before the second century BC, he just took it at face value, and so should we. Some people treat these prophecies like an illusion, like a trick, like someone who knew the end and then went back and conjured up something to make us think that it was something other than what it was in a prediction. This is not like an illusionist. This is not a trick. And the reason is clearly to encourage the Jews, to encourage us that this is not the work of a magician or an illusionist. It's not written after the fact or facts. We see true, genuine, proven, supernatural prophecy at work in this vision. This is not so much about the specifics as much as the character of God who can give the specifics before they happen. As we've said, prophecy is simply history written in advance by God. And that's what we see in this passage. So let's review a little bit what we began last week. Remember, we're dropping into the middle of this vision. We're giving five detailed predictions that reassure God's sovereignty over history. And this outline is going to take us last week, this week, and next week to finish. So you'll remember that we first started with the prophesied rule of the Medo-Persian kings in verse 2. And this basically was God, through the angel, telling Daniel that these prophesied Medo-Persian kings would come to an end after three or four came to the throne. Because after that, we come to the prophesied greatness of Alexander the Great. They would be conquered. Medo-Persia would be conquered by Alexander the Great and Greece in verses 3 and 4. And he tells us exactly that there would be a great man who came, but he would have a very brief rule. And as we know, Alexander comes to the throne at 21 years old. He's dead by 33. And after that, his kingdom is divided into north, south, east, and west with his four generals. But the primary issue that he now deals with in the prophecy are not the east and the west generals, but the north and the south. And that is the prophesied conflicts between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Now, those are the ancient words for the Egyptians and the Syrians. As I said before, this is very important geography. So as you're looking, you have the Mediterranean Sea. That's going to come into play in just a minute from the west. Mediterranean Sea, Syria, Egypt. And the way to get to Syria from Egypt and Egypt from Syria is only one way, Israel, right through the middle of Israel. And this conflict between Egypt and Syria, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, was really the battlefield was Israel. They fought in between them, which was in Israel. Well, in the middle of that conflict, eventually the northern kingdom under the Seleucids, under the Antiochus the first, second, third, and now we're going to meet the fourth, who is Antiochus Epiphanes, began to deal with the battleground people, with the Jews who lived in Israel. So that brings us to number four. And that is the prophesied abomination of Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, as I said last week, there's going to be a lot of historical detail here, and there's no way to deal with it without dealing with the historical detail because it's historical and it's detailed prophecy. I just got to tell you, I had to laugh when I got home because last week I said, I think you're going to be well served not to take notes, just to listen. Just put your notebooks, close them and put your pens down and just listen. And then I had not one, not two, not three, not four, not five, but about a half a dozen women who came and showed me their notes afterwards. And they were better than my sermon notes. I don't even know what to say about that. But you're welcome to take notes if you want to. My suggestion is just listen to what God said would happen and listen to what history tells us did happen. What we're going to look at in each of these verses is the prophecy that the angel told Daniel was going to happen, and then the history, almost all secular history, that says that's exactly what happened. Remember, as we move through this section, that it's a vision given to Daniel by an angel. It is predictive prophecy. So we're going to look at the prediction and how history reveals how it was fulfilled. Let's first look at Antiochus Epiphanes and his despicable character. His despicable character. Verse 21. In his place will arise a despicable person on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. Well, first of all, we have to ask, in whose place? In his place. Well, this is referring to Seleucus IV, Philopater, one of the sons of Antiochus III, who died in 175 BC. In his place is another way of saying, well, he went off the scene and someone else came on the scene, and the one who comes on the scene is namely Antiochus IV or Antiochus Epiphanes. It's noteworthy here that we're going to learn much more about him in a minute, that the first thing we notice about him is he is a despicable person. That's his leading character trait. Now, we've already seen him, if you'll remember back in chapter 8, as the small horn, the little horn we met. And he was despicable in the description there as well. The Hebrew word for despicable is interesting. It means vile, contemptible. Good words to translate this description of Antiochus IV. Despisable, hated. He was a man to be despised and disdained because he was vile and worthless in his character. Remember from our study of this man in chapter 8 that he gave himself the title Antiochus, not the fourth, but Antiochus Epiphanes. That word Epiphanes means the visible God, God manifest. And he thought himself to be the manifestation, the incarnation of Zeus. The people used to have a wordplay on Antiochus Epiphanes, and they called him, the Jews did, Antiochus Epimanes, which means madman, crazy man. He was pure evil, and every evidence of his actions pointed to him, I think, being directly empowered by Satan himself. I just want to say to you now what I said in chapter 8. There are things that I read about his acts against the Jews and even some of the Egyptians that are so disturbing and so vile that I cannot dignify them with a description from the pulpit. Horrific. Text tells us that the honor of kingship has not been conferred. He didn't come by the throne, honestly. But he will come out of a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue, by deception, by manipulation. This speaks of the fact that he was a usurper. Now, here's the history. Evil Antiochus was in Athens at the time when his older brother, Seleucus IV, was murdered by poisoning. And guess who the leading candidate was, the leading suspect was for his poisoning? Antiochus IV. The throne rightly belonged to Seleucus' younger brother, Demetrius, who was just a boy at the time, also being held hostage in Rome, and Antiochus had him murdered. He was a master manipulator of political intrigue, this verse says. He obtained support for his government, get this, by promising lucrative awards to those who supported his rule. He bribed his way into rulership. That's his character that we learn in verse 21. He was a vile man, despicable in his character. In verse 22, we start learning about his military prowess, his military exploits. Verse 22, the overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. This talks about those he overwhelmed. His enemies were overrun. Flooded away. We've already seen that used in Daniel 9 as a military avalanche, flooding the people, flooding his enemies. The prophecy here is that Antiochus would destroy the enemy armies, particularly of Egypt, like a flood. The shattering here of the prince of the covenant is almost certainly a direct reference. And by the way, this is a consensus observation by amillennialists, premillennialists, postmillennialists, all conservative scholars except liberal scholars, that this prince of the covenant was the high priest named Onias, who Antiochus had murdered in 172 BC and turned his brother Menelaus against him. He went right after the central portion of Israel's focus and worship, the temple, and the highest ruler in the temple was the high priest, and he had Onias murdered. He was a brutal military victor and had his enemies subjected to the most horrific tortures after he defeated them. They were flooded away before him and shattered. Thirdly, we find his deceptive dominance. Deceptive is an important word here. After an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception. He'll lie. And he will go up and gain power with a small force of people. That's the prophecy. What do we know from history that actually happened? Well, again, the fulfillment of this historically is amazing. Antiochus makes an alliance with the king of Egypt, which would have been Ptolemy VI at this point. But he deceived him and used the opportunity to execute a stunning defeat with a tiny little army. We're coming in peace. And then he destroyed the welcoming committee. That began a series of retaliatory battles back and forth between Egypt and Syria. And Antiochus ends up winning those battles and conquering Egypt. Verse 24, in a time of peace, in a time of tranquility, once he had won, he will, this is very interesting, and history is so fascinating in the fulfillment of this. He will enter the richest parts of the realm, that's Egypt, the south. He will accomplish what his fathers never did. They didn't control all of Egypt, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder, booty, possessions among them, and he will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time. What actually happened historically? Well, we know that Antiochus campaigned throughout the richest, most productive regions of Egypt and started what could only be called a Robin Hood conquest. Here's what he did, and see if this sounds familiar in any of your political prowess. He said, if I can take the wealth of the rich and give it and distribute it to the poor, there's more poor than rich, then the populace of the poor will support me and I will gain sustained power because I have the poor getting their money from the rich and they know I'm the one distributing that. We call that wealth distribution in our day. Socialism. Communism. He was well ahead of his time. The thought was obvious. Win the favor of the poor who were more populous than the rich by giving them the wealth of the rich. Genius. He will devise schemes against strongholds, but only for a time. It's not going to last, because the Egyptians are going to get a clue. Which takes us to his treacherous victories. This is prophecy, and this is exactly what happened. The angel tells Daniel, Antiochus, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south. Let's just remind ourselves, Who is the king of the south? The king of Egypt. Good class. With a large army. So the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large army and a mighty army for war. This is World War pre-1, if that makes sense. Bigger and bigger armies. They solicit to battle each other, but he will not stand, for schemes will be devised against him. Those who eat his choice food will destroy him, and his army will overflow, but many will fall down. Who's the him in the last part? It's the Egypt king, the king of the south. That was a prophecy to Daniel. What actually happened? Well, we know that Antiochus came against Egypt again, attacking Ptolemy Philometor. And just as this happened, by the way, this battle we have many records of, just east of the Nile Delta in the city of Pelusium. His victory came because Ptolemy was betrayed by, look at that text, those who eat his own choice food. Antiochus bought his most faithful confidants. Those who ate with the king of Egypt. Antiochus wormed his way, schemed his way into them, bribed them to turn against and pull a coup or a mutiny against the king of Egypt. He bought them. Verse 27, as for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil, and they will speak lies to each other at the same table, but it will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time. What is this? Well, I think that's the prophecy. The fulfillment of this prophecy is pretty interesting. It's fascinating. Because these two kings are Antiochus and Ptolemy. They actually came together, sat down at a table, had a feast together to talk about terms of peace. However, both of them lied to each other about their true intentions. Ptolemy becomes the prisoner then of Antiochus Epiphanes. But there's a reason for that. He brings him in because, now it gets more complicated, because Ptolemy had another brother who actually took over in Egypt while he was away at the negotiations. And so Antiochus says, wrongly and lyingly to the Ptolemy he had captured, we're on the same team. Let's go take your brother. But on the other side, Ptolemy pretends to believe him. And they fail. There's a lot of interesting geography here. They go together. They fail to conquer Alexandria, but he's crowned king in Memphis, and they leave for Syria. And Ptolemy ends up going back with his brother and saying, we are now against Antiochus together, and he ran back to Syria. Just a lot of lying, a lot of intrigue, a lot of manipulation, a lot of treachery. So Antiochus pretended to want to help the captive king Ptolemy, but in reality, he had ulterior motive of conquering Egypt back from its new leader. Both entered into this agreement, neither of which intended to keep their agreement, their side of the agreement. But look at the end of that text, verse 27. The end, though, is still to come at the appointed time. Appointed time. Appointed time infers that someone is appointing these events. Who's saying this? The angel. Who's he talking on behalf of? God. Who is appointing all of these events? God is. He's not surprised. He's actually using all of these battles, all of these armies, all of these conquests, even using their lying to each other for his purposes that will be revealed in the coming verses. In verses 28 to 31, we come to his blasphemous abomination. This is really the key to the understanding of Antiochus Epiphanes. His blasphemous abomination. Now, before we jump into these next two verses, let me give you a little context, because verses 28 and 29 predict two different times that he defiled the holy temple of God. Verse 28 represents the first one. Verse 29 the second one. Then he will return to his land, that's Syria, with much plunder. Remember, he had stolen from the rich to give to the poor. You don't think he put a few of those things in his own pocket? He returns to Syria, to his land, with much plunder. But his heart will be set against this little word, the Holy Covenant, is shorthand for the people of the covenant, the people of Jerusalem, the people of Israel. His heart will be set against them, against the Holy Covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land. So that's kind of shorthand for he's coming from Egypt. He's been deceived. Egypt actually has gone because the two brothers got back together and they pushed him back towards Syria. He's angry. He's violently wanting to enact judgment on whoever he can find. And on his way north through Israel, his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant, the people of the covenant. Take action, then he's going to go north after that. Remember the context. This vision is given to Daniel as the people are being released from Babylonian exile, which at the time was under Persian rule. Yet there was coming more persecution and more purging and more trials, and God is gracious to let them know what's coming. I read this verse and I couldn't help but remember that all-important word in James chapter 1, the kindness of God to tell us this, but that word that makes us swallow hard. James said, the half-brother of our Lord said, "Consider it all joy, my brethren, when, not if, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance." In other words, they're coming. God is graciously saying, trials are coming, be ready for them. That's what he's doing in this whole passage to the Jews. It's going to get rough. Hang on to God. So the first defilement of the temple is predicted in verse 28. What happened? Well, Antiochus left Egypt, goes north to Syria, took loads of Egyptian wealth with him on his way back through. Remember, he's traveling north through Israel. As we said, he begins a treacherous persecution of the people of God, the people of Israel. He saw the Jews as rebels to his rule. So he hit them where it hurt the most, their temple worship. First, Antiochus had removed the high priest named Jason, and he installed another man named Menelaus, who had offered him a greater amount of tribute money. It's all about the money. Interestingly, the Jews had heard a rumor during this time that Antiochus was dead in Egypt. And they were holding a celebration celebrating his death when he came to town. Can you imagine that? He's already crazy. He already hates them. He's already persecuting them. And they're doing having a party because they think he's dead. Menelaus withstood the attack that he came, and Antiochus takes action to punish those who had taken part in supporting Jason's rebellion. He was furious. And in this first persecution, listen to this. We covered this in chapter 8. Antiochus killed 80,000 Jewish men, women, and children, and then took 40,000 prisoner and sold them to Rome as slaves. He robs then the temple of its gold and silver vessels and returns to Syria. That's just the first time, and it's not the worst time. Verse 29. I love this. At the appointed time, appointed by whom? Who's talking? The angel. Who's he come from? God. Who is the appointer? God is. Sovereign again. At the appointed time, he will return and come into the south, but this is the last time. It will not return out, and it will not turn out the way it did before. He was very successful before. Antiochus evades Egypt, goes south, goes through Jerusalem again for the third time. He invades Egypt against the joint rulership of those Ptolemy brothers in 168 BC. This time he has less success. Why? Why? Because Egypt called in some reinforcements. Verse 30. For the ships of Kittim, that is an ancient name for Cyprus, this is the Roman navy, will come against him. So he's just been dealing with land battles. Now there are soldiers coming to attack Antiochus from the Mediterranean, from the ships of Kittim, from the Roman soldiers. Therefore, he will be disheartened and will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant, the people of God, and take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. He'll give favor to the traitors to God. By this time, Egypt has reached out for help, and they reached out to Rome, because Rome had a powerful navy and could attack from the west, the sea, that they didn't have any angle. No one attacked from the east, by the way, because that was all desert. No one could come across there. History tells us that Egypt asked Rome for help against Antiochus. And the Roman Senate, there was no emperor at the time, the Roman Senate sends a general to Antiochus with a letter forbidding him from warring again against Egypt. They got Big Brother to help him. Now, the historical account of this is very interesting. The general comes with a whole military entourage to meet with Antiochus from Rome and says, stop warring against Egypt. And Antiochus says, wait. I need some time to think about this. He's a deceiver. He's a schemer. He's a conniver. He was going to figure out a way to get out of this, right? But the general, the emissary, in the sand, draws physically a circle around where Antiochus was standing. In the sand, and he said, no, you will give me an answer to not invade Egypt again before you leave that circle. And if you step out before giving us an answer, we're going to kill you. Antiochus had been had. He relented and gave in to Rome's demands not to invade Egypt again and returns to Syria. Here's a critical fact. He is angry. Furious. And verse 30 says he's going to take it out on Israel, called the Holy Covenant. We find out about that in verse 31. Forces from him will arise, and listen to this, desecrate the sanctuary fortress. As you know, at the time, Jerusalem was surrounded by a wall. That was the fortress. They came over the wall, and they went to do away with the regular sacrifice. That's in the temple. And they will set up the abomination of desolation. Just remember, this is the angel telling Daniel this is going to happen. Now we come to the second temple defilement, the abomination of desolation. We know from history, especially in the book of Maccabees, that Antiochus Epiphanes thought of himself, again, as the manifestation of the Greek god Zeus. His passion was to establish Greek or Syrian, the same thing, culture, and demanded everyone, Jews included, worship Greek deities. But there was a problem. They worshiped Yahweh in the temple. A few of the Jews would not compromise. They would fight back, and they would fight back hard. Antiochus's effort was to Hellenize, to make Greek those in Israel. And as we said when we studied Daniel 8, he was so brutal and ruthless that it would be improper to even mention some of the atrocities that he committed. He made a decree that studying the Jewish scriptures or observing the Sabbath or circumcising Jewish boys was punishable by death. And there are many accounts of him killing people for doing any of those three. Remember what we looked at? Remember, Antiochus Epiphanes is the little horn of Daniel 8. Daniel 8:11. This horn magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host. That's God. He exalted himself to be equal with God and removed the regular sacrifice from him, from God. The place of his sanctuary was then thrown down. This is remarkable. He claimed to be equal with God himself, to be God himself. In short, Antiochus would make himself out to be the object of their worship. He attacks the sacrificial system, makes it obsolete. He forbade sacrifices to be made to the God of Israel in the temple. And then finally, this is the abomination of desolation. A pagan altar was erected over the altar of God in the temple. He rededicated the entire temple of God to Zeus. He sets up an idol and an image of Zeus in the temple. And then the ultimate abomination, he takes a pig and sacrifices it on the altar of God. And it's said that he sprinkled pig's blood in the Holy of Holies. He took the priests, bound them, and forced pork meat down their throats. This happened December 16th. 167 BC, and there are many secular records of it. As we'll see next week, both Daniel 9:24, Jesus and Matthew 24:15 said this sacrilegious act, the abomination of desolation, was a preview of a final abomination of desolation that will take place under the final Antichrist. That's for next week. What's this all about? Well, we come to this final description of Antiochus, his purging persecution. By smooth words, he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant, but the people who know their God will display strength in action. The persecution was prophesied here to have a purifying effect on the Jews. And verse 32 says there's two responses from the Jews. Some would compromise and sell out as traitors and apostates to God. Others would stand faithful to God and their faith, like Judas Maccabeus. I love verse 33. Those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many, yet they will fall by the sword, by the flame, by captivity and plunder for many days. There was a small little revival that happened in the Maccabean revolt. Clearly a prophecy here about the leadership and influence of Judas Maccabeus and that revolt. It started small, says so in Daniel 8, but it gained powerful momentum. And eventually the Jews would recapture the temple under the Maccabean leadership in 165 BC, which is remembered to this day as a celebration called Hanukkah. Verse 34, now when they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join with them in hypocrisy. Again, here's the bifurcation. Those who are joining to follow Antiochus to save their own necks, and those who would join the Lord who gave help. This predicts that though many would fall away in hypocrisy, some only pretended to be loyal to the cause, and they joined with the hypocrisy or false motives or Antiochus's people. John Hyrcanus, Alexander, Yananias. But those Jews who remain committed to God would be provided a little help. The number of Jews who joined the revolt to help with true motives was limited, but it grew. Verse 35, some of those who have this insight about what's happening in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end, because it's still to come at the appointed time. Now the angel reveals to Daniel the reason that God would allow such a persecution. The purpose of all this trouble and suffering for the Jewish people was to refine them, to purge them, and to purify them. There's a shift that's a transition to the next verse and the next paragraph. And that is, he shifts from talking about the end time, probably a reference to Christ's second coming. And it paves the way for verse 36 that we'll start next week, is where the vision jumps thousands of years ahead to the Antichrist. Antiochus then is a prefigurement and a foreshadowing of that great tribulation that will come on the Jews and on the world. So what is this? What do we do with this? Remember, if I can give you a little bit of a visual, the angel tells Daniel what's going to happen during 1st and 2nd century B.C., the Jews are going back to Israel. This is what's going to happen. Everything that was predicted happened exactly as it was predicted. And most of the sources that we know that say it happened that way are secular historical sources. We're on down the road, and we're looking back at that. So what does this have to do with us? Well, first of all, we know that God is going to look out for his covenant people, Israel. And there is a future for them that we'll study in the coming weeks. But also, we believe that a fulfilled, detailed prophecy gives proof that God is sovereign. As his people are struggling and suffering and being persecuted and killed, 80,000 people killed. This is what Jews call the first Holocaust. Where's God? He's on his throne. The devil's in the details. But God is still over all. But you know what else this shows us? God uses, he historically and habitually uses persecution and trials with his people for their holiness, for their purging, their purity, their sanctification. And friends, he still does that today. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let that endurance have its perfect result, that you may be perfect and complete, mature, lacking in nothing. How do you view God's sovereignty? How do you view your trials? How do you view God's sovereignty in your trials? This passage speaks to us from the ancient past right into our living rooms, right into our kitchen, and gives us theology for perspective.